Fireside Chat. I hope everybody's doing well on this Friday. What is the date today? Friday the 19th of December. And today, I'm recording my second episode for the day. I recorded one earlier, and this would be 147, if I remember correctly. Episode 147, I have the distinct pleasure and honor to have with me Bruno Herrmann. Bruno joined me from Brussels in Europe. And I am in Canada, where it's currently 8 a.m. in the morning. I don't know what time it is for you, Bruno. Welcome to the channel, by the way.
Thanks a lot, Robin. Thanks for having me. It's 2 p.m. for me, so I'm much more comfortable, probably.
Absolutely. I'm still sipping on my first coffee, Bruno. So good to see you again. It's good to see you again. I don't see you often, and I always miss our conversations. So thank you for being so generous with your time and joining the conversation today.
Always good to talk to you, Robin. It's always a pleasure to share some latest and greatest of what's happening in the exciting world of language management and other industries as well. So,
and as you can see, I still have the the Christmas stuff on the wall there. That's not a virtual wall. And I'm using this time of year, like when I do these podcasts, to sort of do like a reflection on the year. What did we do? What are we going to do next year? Let's sort of summarize what happened and what is going to happen in the future. So, we'll use the conversation, you and I, just to see what has transpired in 2025 that is exciting, that we shared a laugh or two sometimes about, or we cried. It doesn't matter.
Yes, absolutely.
So how are you first? How are you? How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. I mean, we are going to talk about it in a minute, but this year has been very challenging and exciting at the same time. So I don't complain about the lack of opportunities. It's, of course, when I say challenging, it's, of course, challenging because of, so many things that have been changing or transforming. You might say, no, that's not new, Bruno. Well, I know it's not new, but it doesn't take away the fact that this year has been really transformative in many ways, humanly, process-wise, from a technology perspective. So, things are still sometimes a bit groovy or bumpy, depending on how you look at it. But overall, I think it's good to see some positive evolution. Well, positive from my perspective. So probably not everyone will agree with my view. But I think that being in this position of advising and consulting with organizations or leaders about their global content strategies and their global product operations is a good place to be. And again, it's not new, but I think this year it has been a really good place to be because it has given me a chance to really look at various facets of, the evolution that we are going through right now. Of course, from a language management perspective, it has been also a very important year with many things happening. But since I don't consider myself as part of the language industry, I consider myself as part of the language community, but not of the industry, because I know many people consider the industry as suppliers. And I'm more on the client side, so on the enterprise side. And of course, I belong to the language community, but I am part of the life science industry. I'm part of the BI industry, and I'm part of the tech industry, because these are the industries where I'm creating value. I'm not creating value directly in the language industry, but I'm sure you will have plenty of questions about that. So I stop here.
Yeah, no problem. I really appreciate it. And in context, this is a very interesting position to be in, to be on the enterprise side, to be on the customer side. And you're right, we need advocates on the customer sides, right? So not necessarily the customer has to. I feel like sometimes the language industry needs an intermediary. And this is where you come in. We're not just probably you, but there may be others in that same position, but you is the more vocal about that, and your more presence in that space, and especially with your background. I mean, you worked with this on the customer side, using the enterprise as using the industry as a service provider, and you've dealt with service providers many times. And obviously, since you left that space, technology has shifted, processes has shifted a little bit, but it hasn't left you as who you are with the enterprise advocate. You know how people buy translation services. You know how people buy localization services. And what makes a good purchase from your perspective? that's all very helpful, because at the end of the day, everybody's looking for that customer. Everybody's looking for to make a deal, but they don't want to just make a deal. The customer wants to make a good deal with an innovative company, with a company that wants to provide good services to them and be ethical in the way they do it. And on the opposite side, the enterprise side, on the localization side of things, they're looking for good customers as well. So in your opinion, in 2025, have you seen any shift in the behavior, both on the customer side and the localization enterprise side? And what are they?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, yes, I've seen some evolution, at least in two areas. Let's take just two areas for this conversation. The first part is what I call the human factor in this tech-driven world, in the AI world. I think, you know, when we were still in the hype of AI, many people, unfortunately, were making bets or promises about, you know, technology replacing people, or at least, kicking a number of people out of their industry. And I think that now we are in the post-hype period, or the post-hype phase of AI deployment. So a number of people have come back with more realistic expectations, more realistic promises sometimes. I think, you know, I call this, bring them back to earth, because some people were really flying around when AI was so hype, and they said, well, just like we saw it, and Robin, you saw it as well, when we saw it in the beginning of the digital transformation years, when the internet was taking off, everybody was saying, oh yeah, you know, with the internet, with the websites, the number of people will be out of the game, which happened for some people, unfortunately, but not with the magnitude that was announced. And I think that
There's an underlying story there. I'll tell you about it in a second.
Oh, I'm sure. I have plenty of stories as well. But, you know, something that is very interesting for myself and for you and many other people is that since we are now old enough to put things in perspective and say, okay, AI is a game-changing technology, but we can actually remember some lessons that we took years ago, decades ago, from the digital transformation efforts that we made, because indeed there was a hype as well 25 years ago when the internet was taking off, but a number of mistakes were made 25 years ago, and I can see that some of these mistakes were made and are still made probably today with AI. So it's very interesting for us, or for more experienced people who are sometimes called the old people.
Young at heart.
But that's a benefit for us, actually, to put things in this perspective of tech evolution. I think we'll see it in the future with quantum computing, I'm sure. Every time there is a major milestone in the language history and in the tech history in general, there are some, I would say, some things that are repeating themselves. We say that history repeats itself in many cases. And it's true in technology. It's very true in technology. It's very true in language technology specifically, which brings me to the other area that I would like to call out, which is that I still see, and I don't mean to be negative. I say that in a very constructive way, but I still see some gaps or some misunderstanding, miscommunication between some suppliers and some clients. You mentioned that, of course, it has to be a win-win framework. You know, suppliers want to have good clients and clients want to have good suppliers. So it has to be a win-win. There cannot be a loser and a winner. That's not going to work. That's my personal take. And as you said, I worked so many years on the client side. I always wanted to elevate and integrate my suppliers in the business processes of the companies I worked in. I didn't want to consider them as transactional vendors. I could have done that, you know, to be honest. Yes. Many people around me were saying, oh, why do you engage those suppliers so much or so often? And I said, it's because I consider them as business partners, not just vendors. And I think, you know, that was my own way, my humble way of filling the gap that unfortunately was existing and still exists, not just in the language management area, but also in other industries between suppliers and clients. So I think that gap should not be as wide as it is sometimes, and it should be dealt with, it should be addressed in a more constructive way, because as I said, it's a partnership. If a client has a good supplier, the supplier is winning and the client is winning. I think that's, and to be honest, the reason why I mentioned this tech space. I think this year in 2025, I've seen some very nice efforts or initiatives to close this gap by moving from, I would say, experimentation to implementation. And I think that's when suppliers can really make a difference. It's of course very useful to experiment with suppliers. If you're on the client side, I always did that, even before AI. So it was always good to have suppliers willing to join pilots, to join experiments. But I think the real value, and this is about value creation for clients most of all, the real value comes when you are implementing it and when you are deploying it. So I think in the past years, let's say until the end of 2024, much of the AI space or environment was made of pilots, tests, experiments, etc., which was good. But now this year, I've seen more implementation and deployment efforts, which is when, as we say, when the rubber hits the road, you know, when there is a real obvious evidence that, you know, technology and suppliers providing technology or services can create value.
Now, on that one, we always talk about the relationship between a supplier and a customer. And I mentioned this before on one of my, I don't know, 3-4 episodes before this one, where I mentioned on the fact that this industry made a big mistake early on, 30 years ago, in commoditizing the business. Commoditizing the business meaning you made it a commodity. So there's a tug of war between being a commodity and being professional services. And so now, I guess, somebody's waking up somewhere and saying, oh, we're professional services. But 30 years ago, we put the first cornerstone for the industry. And the cornerstone was on a per word rate charges. That was the initial, I want to call it the nail in how not to build an industry, a professional industry, by commoditizing it down to a per word rate. And now we're moving away from that and we're trying. And people are trying to move away from the per word rate. They can't quantify it. It's very difficult for now to quantify how do we present our services to our customer, because what is the effort involved in this? And nobody wants to deliver services for the sake of delivering services. Nobody's a philanthropist. Nobody's going to do it for free. There got to be a three-way cut in any transaction. You want to, you know, you got to give something to the employee who's working on these projects. You got to keep some profitability, and you got to deliver value to your customer, which is your value, your favorite topic. Are we delivering value to the customer? And how do you see all this working out now in 2025 and going beyond to 2026?
Yeah, I think you mentioned it. You know, value creation is my North Star. You know, it should be for everyone in any industry. If you don't create value, why do you have a job? Why do you work? I mean, it would be a bit unusual or even weird to work without creating value for someone or for something. I know it's a bit philosophical, but that's the reality. It's not just business. It's life in general. Why do you do what you do? The why. And you know, I said it in several presentations this year, and I know it's a difficult topic because when you talk about business or even life in general, people focus a lot on what, how, where, when. These are the main questions that come up in their mind immediately. And I think it's human. It's human nature. But for me, and specifically in business, the first question is why. Why do we do what we do? It's a question for both clients and suppliers. Mm-hmm. It's a question for suppliers. Why do we serve clients? Why do we want to delight clients? Why? To help them to solve business issues, to drive growth on their side, etc. So there are a number of reasons that can be called out to explain why a supplier should be working with a client. On the client side, same thing. Why should I work with a supplier? Because maybe I can do things on my own, maybe not. I don't have the capacity, I don't have the capabilities, but some suppliers have that. So I should engage with suppliers. And I think value creation, so which is the why in the discussion, is difficult because of course it drives and it is the cause of success. It's the root of success, I would say. But it's also the cause of some issues and failed projects, because it means that people were just rushing to technology. They were rushing to processes without, you know, first defining the why. And they were, it's a bit like, you know, driving a car without wheels. You never know where you are going to end up. So it's very difficult to say, yeah, you know, I have great technology. And then 6 months later, my projects have failed. Oh, my technology is bad. No, technology is not bad. It's you who who are bad because you didn't use technology in the right way. So I see this sort of challenge continuing in 2026, where value creation is going to be more important than ever. Very, 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 I would say, obviously in some industries. And I think that it's a challenge, as I said in the past minutes, it's a real challenge, but it's an opportunity to really sort of, you know, to change what needs to be changed, to calibrate operations in the right way, to review value propositions. You mentioned the words a few minutes ago. Value propositions should be really adapted and upgraded according to what is now needed. Mm-hmm. And of course, there will be more changes in 2026. Of course, there is actually a change now every day or every week in the world of AI. So, you know, it's difficult to follow indeed. You know, I think that this is going to be the North Star still shining in 2026, at least for me and for the people I know, because it's going to be even more critical and even more even important to make it sustainable, to justify what is needed. You know, any tech investment, AI or non-AI, any investment in processes, in operational models, must be justified by something. And the something is not specifically, not just the performance. Did we do it well? Did we do it not well? No, it's the value. What is the value at the end of the road? What is the value at the end of the journey? For the customer, of course, but also for the organization producing the value. So I think that it would be really good to keep moving away from quality discussions and sort of vanity metrics. Oh, you know, I did so much so quickly. Yeah, great. That's operational performance. But what is next? Was it effective? Was it creating value? These are the other questions I would like to see answered more often, not just for me, but in general, because I think that it's a shame that a number of projects and a number of initiatives that are really good, that are really necessary, fail because of a lack of why. The why is not defined. It's not
well articulated.
Yeah. And to be honest, that's my personal experience. I think that the vast majority of people understand that. But the problem is that some people, maybe it's a minority, but unfortunately, sometimes these people are very vocal. A minority of people don't accept this change. And you mentioned about commodity in the language industry. I think this is a major topic. I think that now I advised a few people this year, a few companies, to move away from, you know, the rates per word, which is the sort of legacy of the past decade.
It's the death of the industry.
Yeah, well, yeah. And to move to value-driven rates, performance-driven, from, you know, output, from outcome. I mean, moving from output to outcome. This is a major difference. Output is commodity. Outcome is performance and value.
Yeah. What did you do with that content, basically? What was the end results of it? Did you make it, if you're doing an e-commerce platform, did that make you buy more? Did it convert to more business? Do you have more visitors to your website because of what we did? Did you capture more clients? Revenue went up, you know, customer satisfaction. All these things needs to go into the calculation and needs to be quantified and put a price on it versus, oh, I only I translate 2,000 words a day. Or something to that, or to something to that matter. No, I was doing an earlier conversation with another individual, Albison. I guess the podcast will be posted next week, and I was so impressed with her strategy of putting AI first. And so most people in the industry, and that's even in 2025, with the exception of few, of course, not everybody, will say they will talk about AI, but they will talk it as a side topic. Mm-hmm. They will put it in their dialogues and the marketing material, but as a side topic. We do all these 200 things, but then at the bottom down there somewhere, there'll be a key point about AI, which should be at the top, and it's hiding in the bottom. It sort of gives me the impression that you have an entire industry in 2025 still shy about mentioning, and they're all using AI. They all have some sort of an AI on the work, on the go. They're still shy about saying AI first. Why is that?
Oh, yeah, that's something that I noticed as well, to be honest. And I agree with you. It's a shame to see that. I think that the typical advice that I give to the people I'm talking to, not just working with, but the people I'm talking to like you today, is that if you are a business owner, if you are a leader in an organization, I think that, of course, AI first is something that comes to your mind quite quickly. But I think at the end of the day, my recommendation is to talk about customer first, user first, because that's where, that's how you are going to infuse AI in your organization, in your process in the right way. I will give you a couple of examples. So I worked with a company this year that was a little bit rushing to AI, and they wanted to rebrand themselves as AI. They even rebrand their website, moving from .com to .ai. But okay, that's a very different discussion. But I realized that they want to be AI first without specifically being customer first. So sometimes being AI first might be a little bit too selfish or egocentric, because it means that you are looking at your company and you're not looking at what your customers are expecting. So AI first can be a good match. But of course, if your customers are not requiring AI first, they want to be experience first or value first, you have to infuse AI and not rush to it, because then you can calibrate how you're going to use AI. And it's for, in some cases, it's good to say, yes, we do need to be AI first, because we are in an industry like, of course, the life science industry, which I know well. It's in pharmaceutical, you have to be AI first, because being AI first means being patient first. So it's about human health. You are really creating, you are adding a lot of value by using AI. So it makes sense to be AI first. In some other industries, like, you know, the legal industry, I'm not a big expert, but I work with a couple of people who are in that industry, and they noticed a number of mistakes that were made by people willing to be AI first, but serving customers that were not AI first. They were not expecting AI first. They were expecting AI infusion, meaning, you know, infusing AI in some processes in the ecosystem, but sometimes not, because it was not the right time and not with the right people. So I said that in several presentations this year. If you want to make the best use of AI, don't immediately rush to being an AI first. Keep going as a customer first. And then if you are a customer first, a client first organization, you can start defining the why AI is going to be relevant or not. And of course, there are a number of cases where AI is helping a lot. There are some cases where it's helping somehow, and there are cases where AI is not helping so much. When I say not helping so much, meaning that the investment cost is not offsetting, that the value created is not offsetting the investment cost. So it has to be, to avoid being sort of trusting AI blindly, it's really important to really stick to this customer first approach. And sometimes indeed, when I see a company telling me, or, you know, displaying on the website, we are AI first, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, what does that mean?
What does that mean? Because then if I see my favorite e-commerce site, they say with a banner, we are AI first now, I want to know how it's going to be beneficial for me as a customer. Maybe it's beneficial for them, right? Great. But, you know, is it beneficial?
There's a lot of buzzwords out there, Bruno. So there's a lot of buzzwords.
So AI doesn't have to be a buzzword. It has to be, as I said, the North Star. Value creation with AI has to be the North Star, but it cannot be sort of a buzzword. And of course, you know, there has been a number of articles this year about AI washing. Just we saw green washing decades ago. Now it's AI washing. Because of course, when people use AI or other terms as buzzwords, then of course, there is nothing behind it. You have to scratch the surface. That's my advice usually.
True. You got to dig a little deeper.
Yeah.
Now, your favorite topic that you always talk about is reskilling, retooling your internal staff to match the changes in any industry, not just necessarily in the localization industry, which is more familiar with, but it doesn't matter. It's a horizontal topic. It goes across many industries. How do you think we've done globally on that topic in 2025? What do you think it's going to be in 20? Because I've seen a lot of layoffs, right? So, and there was a wave of layoffs in the industry here in 2025. Many people lost their jobs. I mean, people say many reasons, which you talked about a little earlier. I'm just kind of, you know, one of the things that people talk about is AI, you know, AI, AI, AI.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. The second thing is when you see waves of layoffs and, you know, people are losing their jobs and people are saying, you know, AI is causing that. I don't think so. And I don't believe so.
Mm-hmm.
This is a either mismanagement. Mm-hmm. B is management, maybe getting rid of like the B operators, if you will, or the C operators. And I don't believe there was a lot of thinking in the way they operated to begin with, to reskill, retool, redevelop, and put these people in a different position or get them to do different jobs with the new realities, with the new technologies that are out there, right? So when I see this combination of people, we're not talking about few, we're talking like we've seen it in large companies, hundreds and thousands in some cases, losing their jobs in the industry where we keep talking about how valuable the human is, how valuable the professional, whatever that professional, project manager, translator, desktop publisher, that are well needed to verify, to validate, to make sure that the outcome to the end user, to the customer, it's mm-hmm. still there, still valid. And thousands of these people lose their jobs. I don't believe we've reskilled, retooled, as you were talking about. What's your takes on that?
Yeah, no, you're right. I think AI is not just a buzzword for some people, but it's also some sort of excuse to do things that they have to do anyway, but they want to blame AI for that.
100%.
Unfortunately, it's still today, AI is blamed for not being good. And of course, people don't even look at the data that has been used to train the AI. So it's always, you know, I used that phrase in a presentation a few months ago. It's a Chinese proverb that says, you know, when the wise man is showing the moon, most people are looking at the finger showing the moon. They're not looking at the moon. So I think that this is human nature. Again, I don't say that in a very negative way. It's just that indeed people blame AI for not being efficient, but they forget to look at what has been done to actually train the model, create the prompt, and use the data properly. Also, I agree with you, AI has been blamed for laying off people. But actually, there are two root causes that I've seen that are not related to AI directly. It was the use of AI that was too quick, too far. Then, of course, people were not ready. They didn't have the right level of AI fluency or AI literacy to actually be part of this evolution, be part of this transformation. So there was a lack of reskilling, the lack of upskilling. And because of that, some organization said to these people, oh, you're not able to use AI, too bad for you. You know, it's time to let you go. That's the first root cause, or the first false cause, I should say, to blame AI for layoffs. The second root cause is not even technology, Robin. It's actually the economy. Sometimes some companies have hired massively. They have recruited thousands of people after COVID, and they forgot to calibrate that recruitment, you know, according to the needs. So they recruited sometimes more people than they needed to. And now they realize that they can't afford it anymore. So they say, oh, yeah, we have 1,000 people in the company, and these 1,000 people are no longer creating value for the company and for the clients. So it's time to let them go. But we cannot say that to them directly. So we're going to say, sorry, guys, but due to AI, due to automation, we have to let you go. And so that is an excuse, of course, that's the economy. It's nothing to do with it's bad management, mismanagement. You said it.
Yep.
There's some people, and obviously you know that because,
yep.
You know, I saw you joined International Achievers this year, and recruiting and selecting people has been more important than ever. Not just the right people, but the right number of people.
100%.
As well. That is so important. So AI blamed sometimes for things that are not created or due to AI.
Yeah, back in the days when I was in the tech sector, when I was building things for people to use, I had a few acronyms. This is for us, the two of us here and the audience who's listening in on this one. Probably this will bring back memories. There is a term called, there's a couple of terms I want to run by you. One is called BEPCAC. That's PEBKAC, which is problem exists between the keyboard and the chair. And there's another one called PICNIC, which is problem in the chair, not in the computer. And there is another one called layer 8 issue. This is very technical, by the way. Layer 8, that's the, as people know, like the seven layers of connectivity, of network, of application development. So we start from the ground all the way up to layer 8. Layer 8 being the user, it's called the layer 8 issue.
Wow, okay. I just learned something, that's great. I learned one thing of the day, so I've learned my lessons now.
Absolutely.
No, but you know what? I think there is something more profound when we talk about AI and specifically how AI is used. You mentioned it, you know, sometimes it's mismanagement, miscalibration, misuse in general, let's put it like that. And I think this is, since we have in the audience, we have a number of people who are involved in language management, a supplier or a client. I think there is, you know, you mentioned that I have a few obsessions professionally, just professionally. But one of my other obsessions, which goes back to 1999, when I moved to, you know, being a project manager to being a manager, a people manager, this obsession was about and is about integrating and elevating language management, so language services, language technology, but elevating these assets and integrating them into the big picture. What is the big picture for me? It is global content operations or global product management. I think many in my life, many localization or language services people came to me by complaining that they were not recognized, they were not celebrated in their organization. And they said that they were just a team, but they were not integrated in the business processes. They felt they were not very part of the business. And of course, as a result of that, they were considered as a cost center and not as a profit driver, which is a shame because language management is driving profits as well. So my advice has always been the same. But again, this is very controversial. And I know when I say that, I have a bunch of people willing to throw tomatoes at me. And they want to say, oh, yeah, but, you know, the language industry is so strong that it can do without, or, you know, there is no need to really be integrated in the bigger picture. And I totally disagree with that. I think 100%. That in my life, I've always tried for myself, but also for my teams. And I've seen that around me.
Yep.
When you start integrating language management, which, by the way, is much more than just translation localization. It's content creation, it's testing, it's UX. So language management and language expertise is across the supply chain of any product and any content. But I said to these people, lean into the business processes of your organization. And I said the same thing to suppliers. Don't be a commodity transactional vendor. Be a business partner that can lean into the business processes of your client so that you can demonstrate that you create value and you drive profits, you drive growth, etc. But to do that, you cannot just stay outside the supply chain. You have to be integrated and elevated in the supply chain for content, for products, because the supply chain is the value chain. So there is no way around that.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, as I hear you talk about this, it's because we've been through a lot as an industry. And, you know, you mentioned like people who are going to be listening to you and going to say we're very strong on our own. We don't need to be integrated. That causes me to think on multiple level here to say maybe those people should be laid off. That's one, because they don't see the big picture. And this industry needs a big picture thinkers and drivers and value driving individuals in the industry, not necessarily people with 20, 30 years of experience doing the same thing over and over again. That's the definition of insanity, in my opinion. In my opinion, I'm just repeating what Einstein said, I guess, in this case, and expecting different results. So that's my take on that. The second thing is that I feel like, and I'm not sure if you agree or not, when you have an industry that is completely, but if you look at the diagram of business, any business process, you look at where translation sits, it absolutely sits inside of the process. Now, the ranking, is it at the beginning? Is it at the end? Toward the end, generally. But it's absolutely integrated into the process, like from a diagram perspective. And when you say to customers, hey, email me your content, I translated, who wants to email anymore? Who wants to send you an email to translate content? You better be integrated into their business processes. Now, when we talk about integration, there are several dilemmas, obviously. 13,000 content management systems, you're not going to be able to integrate all of them. And if you do, you're probably going to integrate the top 10. You're not going to be able to integrate all of them. So you need access to content. That's my point. And customers who are willing to take on a small spend supplier, let's say I'm spending $1 million on everything, and I've got this translation thing and I'm spending $10,000 on it per year. If I'm taking that $10,000 spent supplier, I'm going to say, okay, now I got to integrate you into my business and bring you in into my processes. And so I don't have to email you anymore. You are part of my fabric as I operate. A, you created a scenario where the customer, in this case, you're on your side, the client side, feels that I've created a situation I can't get rid of. It's very sticky. I can't remove it out. And let's say I want to remove it out after 5 year of the contract or 3 year end of contract. I need the option to remove it. And I can't do that. There's many complexities. My point is, there's many complexities with that. The key is continue driving toward, I get where you're going, continue driving toward that objective, continue driving toward that goal, and keep in mind that we need to integrate. And when we integrate, we need to keep it all these factors in place. And we want to make sure that we're integrating in a way that the customer can have the flexibility, multi-vendor, for instance. Some customers wants to be able to choose multi-vendor and want those multi-vendors to be integrated. Nobody wants to do manual work anymore. Nobody wants to cut and paste, put it into an email, send it to a vendor. Nobody wants to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is another benefit of integrating and elevating language management, so translation, localization, creation, etc. But there is another benefit of integrating and elevating these activities in content and product supply chains is for internal teams or for suppliers, is to understand how an organization is connecting the dots between the human capital, the business processes, and the tech ecosystems. I think this is a sort of the winning trio for any business, globally or locally, by the way, it's not just for global organizations, to actually say and prove that they can connect the human, the tech, and the process dots to make everything work. And that's part of the chain. I'm using the supply chain all the time, or chain, value chain or supply chain. I'm using these words all the time because that's something that any business has. The smallest company in the world has a supply chain for a product, for content, and the biggest one as well. So there is something, the foundation, the first layer of the foundation of any business is really the supply chain, which is for me the same as the value chain. Both supply chains and value chains must be synchronized.
Well, they contribute to creating value chains, right? If you have the wrong supplier removed. So
there is sometimes, I remember this year, I met someone who said to me, but Bruno, you are using some operational jargon when I was saying supply chain. And I said, why? That person said to me, it's because supply chains for me is when you are producing cars. You know, there is a supply chain where there is someone, you know, checking the engine, checking the wheel, etc. And I said, well, supply chain is not, well, of course, it's an operational concept. But if there is no supply chain, just tell me, where is the value chain? Tell me. And that person couldn't say anything. So I said, no, supply chains, value chains are not just operational. It's to be considered by everyone, from IT to marketing, from marketing to product management. But I think that for language management and for the audience that we have today, I'm sure many people are, you know, sort of facing this challenge of, you know, proving and maintaining their value in their business, is actually, you know, to be part of, or to lean, what I said, the lean into the business processes so that they can prove their value and they can prove that they are more than just a cost center. That they are even worse than cost center, a cost driver. That's what I heard this year many times, that language services people or language services suppliers were considered as cost drivers by procurement teams, which is terrible.
Yeah.
So it has to be accepted and it has to be understood. Understood is easier than accepted, but it has to be clear that, you know, language management, services, tech altogether is part of supply chains and value chains. If they're not, I have big concerns for the people who are in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we wrap up, Bruno, what is your goals, I guess, or objective or hopes or desires for 2026?
I will stick to hopes because I don't make predictions. I'm still looking for this famous crystal ball that you mentioned last time.
That's right. Crystal ball. That's a good one.
Where did you buy it? I checked Amazon. I checked all the websites. I couldn't find any crystal balls. I'm still looking for.
So note to the audience, if you know where to find a crystal ball, please send us a link here so we can find a crystal ball for Bruno.
I badly need it. So, so my hopes or my expectations, if I want to be a bit bolder, is that, first of all, the human factor remains as important as it has become this year, in my opinion. Of course, I cannot speak for all industries. I'm focusing on three industries, life science, BI, market research, and tech. So I don't know how the defense industry would react to that. But of course, I would expect the human factor to become and to become really, I would say, paramount in the definition of AI initiatives. The second hope would be that we would move from experimentation to more implementation. so that we can start getting to the real business and make sure that AI and humans together can reach this sweet spot between augmentation and automation. I think that's really key. From a language technology perspective, I would hope that indeed there would be more from content management, but also from translation management and others, learning system, etc., that there would be more unification. I don't use the word integration because that's a dream, but more unification in ecosystems, so that some companies, and it's not applicable to any company, having worked myself in multinationals, I know centralizing and integrating all systems in one ecosystem is just a dream, but at least it would be more unified, even if it's sometimes a bit loosely connected, but that language technology becomes more unified with the rest of the ecosystem, so that the value of language technology can become more obvious to the decision makers. When you talk to a CTO, a CIO, most of them, they don't even know what a TMS is or what or what an MT is. So it's important to educate and to, not just to educate, but also to prove that language technology is as important as content management technology. And last but not least, that's one of my obsessions, of course, is that we keep demonstrating the value of language management overall. So I'm not talking here just about translation localization, but language management from creation to delivery, that we keep demonstrating the value of it, that we have more. And for me, there is one, my obsession has a name, actually. It's called language intelligence. I know people who follow me, they hear or they see this word quite often from my side. What is language intelligence? My definition is quite simple. Is how you leverage language management to create value. That is as simple as that. Simple to say, but not simple to implement.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you, Bruno, for your conversation today. I really appreciate it. We've done a summary. We talked about everything pretty much here in the past 48 minutes. And I really appreciate you joining me today on this podcast. It's always good to see you. I guess we'll be talking in about an hour or two.
Yeah,
again, absolutely. On another call together. I really want to thank, if there are any other comments, if there is any final thoughts before.
No, I think I mentioned my hopes. So don't take that as predictions. Don't come back to me in December 2026 and say, well, Bruno, you were wrong. This is my hope. These are my hopes. But I think that there are a number of opportunities. So I always look at the half full glass, not the half empty glass. So I think, yes, there will be more challenges. There will be more business issues to solve. But behind each issue or each challenge, there is an opportunity. That's how I see it.
I really appreciate it, Bruno. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
For the audience, thank you so much for joining us as we wrap up another episode here. And I thank everybody for being part of this podcast. And I'll see you at the next one.